You're on the Plants Grow Here podcast. I'm Daniel Fuller. Come along with me as we enter a hidden world of deep horticultural, ecological, and landscape gardening knowledge with featured experts, industry professionals, and enthusiasts. When was the last time you bought yourself a new house plant? Is it time to visit your local nursery and buy yourself something special? Or maybe you're looking for a Christmas present for a plant lover, but you don't know what to get them. Jane Perrone is host of the On the Ledge podcast, and she's an indoor plant pro. If you aren't subscribed to her awesome podcast, you may recognize her voice from episode 147 of the Plants Grow Here podcast, where she gave us an intro to indoor plants, how to choose the best stock at your local nursery, and general care tips. In this episode, we're about to discuss 13 of the best house plants, from the common and easy to grow to the uncommon and expert level plants. Stick around to the end of the episode to hear the full list, or go straight to the show notes right now. So, welcome back to the show, Jane.
Hi, how are you?
Yeah, really well, thank you. Look, today I'm really excited because we're going to delve back into houseplants. And I know that that's a bit of a misnomer because there's no such thing as a houseplant. These are low-light plants. But I'd really like to start this episode off by getting you to tell us a little bit about your brand new project, Houseplant Gardener in a Box.
Yeah, so this is something that's just come out and I worked on last year, and it's kind of what the title suggests. It's a box containing 60 cards and a booklet, and each card has an illustration on one side by Cody Bond, and then on the other side, words by me which tell you about the plant, give you a kind of a little potted guide to what this plant is about, what it's like, what it needs. And I think a lot of people will love this just for the fact that you've got these 60 beautiful cards, which you could use to display, or, you know, you could just have them in the box as a reference point. But then you've also got a booklet in there, which has got lots on everything from buying plants to where to put them, dealing with problems and so on. So yeah, I think it's going to be one of those things that people maybe pick up as a gift for themselves or for somebody else. Mm. I love gifting things to myself personally. Yeah. Because I know I'm going to love it. But yeah, hopefully at the same time, it's also packed with loads of really actually useful information about these plants that you can just go through. They're arranged in different categories as well. So you can go straight to the unusual plants or the cacti and succulents, depending on what your particular interests are.
I think we're going to hit a lot of these different categories today, Jane. I'd like to start off by just acknowledging the fact that the title is a little bit misleading because there's no such thing as a best plant. Really, what we're talking about, we're being a little bit cheeky and a bit facetious with that title, aren't we?
Well, I mean, you know, my best plants will change on a daily, weekly basis, depending on what's going on with my plants. Yeah. And which one's looking good. And strangely, there are some plants that I would say, oh, that's definitely one of my best plants, really easy. And then somebody else would come along and say, that's hellish. You know, I can't grow that. I meet a lot of, you know, people who are into, say, aroids, who say, well, I can't grow cacti and succulents. And oftentimes it's not a case of they can't grow them. It's just that they don't have the right conditions. So, you know, unless you've got a big south facing window, cacti and succulents are going to be problematic unless you can supplement with grow lights. So one person's best is another person's nightmare. But that said, there are some plants that are incredibly adaptable. Yeah. That's why they've made it as successful houseplants, because they will put up with all kinds of different conditions. And I think that's the category that a lot of these plants fall into.
Absolutely. So you said south-facing window there. That applies to you guys in the UK.
It'll be a different thing over here. Yeah, of course, sorry, I should say. I forgot that I'm speaking to somebody on the other side of the world. Yeah, obviously, it's not the same for you. Basically, you're looking for somewhere where wherever the maximum sunlight coming through your window is. Sometimes people get panicky about, oh, I don't know which way my house points. Well, just use your eyes. You don't need to know the compass points. You just need to observe through the course of the day. Yeah, and where the light's coming into the room, and how is it moving around the room, which it will do, and which spots are being hit by sunlight at different times of day. So we kind of tend to make it sound a bit scary and, oh gosh, I'm going to have to like get the car. I don't know where my house points. You don't need to do that. You just need to observe.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you said like one of the best all-rounders there in terms of like being able to survive with plenty of light or low light. I think really we're going to have to start with Monstera Deliciosa, aren't we?
Well, yeah, it's on the cover of the Houseplant Gardener in a Box, so yeah. It's a good place to start. And, you know, this plant is just incredibly adaptable and tough. It's just so tough. I mean, it will put up with all kinds of neglect. And so that's why it really should be in amongst these very best of the houseplants. And if you grow it well, that said, it will reward you by looking absolutely amazing. If you sort of give it the very minimum, it doesn't look quite as great, but you've still got a nice plant.
Yeah. So when we're talking about care for this plant, I think a lot of the things that we're going to talk about are going to apply to multiple plants, if not almost all of the plants. But how do you care for a Monstera Deliciosa or the Swiss cheese plant?
So this really is a case of trying to make sure that you are fulfilling its needs. It's quite a hungry plant, and it's a plant that will take quite a lot of light. It probably isn't going to be sitting with your cacti and succulents, but it will be happy in a situation where it's getting some morning sun, provided that it's had a chance to kind of build up a bit of resistance. You know, don't just move it straight from the darkest corner into sunlight. You know, and when I was researching my book that came out earlier this year, you know, I found that this is a plant that grows, it's been naturalized in tropical parts of the world. You know, it grows, it's native to Mexico and Guatemala, but it's spread to lots of tropical regions because it is so adaptable. So, you know, researchers found it everywhere from growing up oil palms in oil palm plantations to growing at very low altitudes, growing at very high altitudes, surrounded by cacti in Mexico. So it's really, really adaptable. But the main thing where people go wrong with this plant is usually that they neglect to pay attention to what's going on under the surface as opposed to looking at the leaves. So this is a plant that will drink quite a lot of water. It's quite a thirsty plant because it's got these big juicy roots, but at the same time you need to make sure that that soil isn't getting overly waterlogged, because that will just result in the leaves turning yellow, the roots rotting, and when you've got roots as large as the roots of this plant, when they rot, it's not a happy experience. It's going to be unpleasant. So yeah, I mean, I would say the other thing that people really often neglect with this plant as well is feeding. So it does need to be regularly fed when it's in active growth, and you can just use any foliage houseplant feed for that. And then it's also just a question of looking after its needs in terms of support. So the Swiss cheese plant, Monstera Deliciosa, grows in the wild. It either starts off on the ground and grows into trees, or it might start growing in the nook of a tree and then grow to the ground. As I said before, it's incredibly flexible, but it has this network of aerial roots that help it to anchor onto whatever it's growing onto, but also reach down to the ground for extra to seek out extra nutrients and water. So you've got to think about those roots. If you've got a mature plant, they're going to go everywhere. People have all kinds of solutions to this. People say, oh, tuck them back into the pot. If you've ever tried to actually wrangle with one of these things, they're not very flexible. No. So you can cut them off. If you cut them off, they will regrow. And you need to cut them off right at the base, otherwise they'll just branch into a million little roots. But they are a feature of the plant. And of course, if you want to emulate the wild, you are going to give it something to climb up or at least be supported by. And there's so many different things you can do. People always talk about moss poles. I'm not a massive fan of moss poles. You can just use some stakes. You can use a plank of wood. You can use some kind of obelisk. Anything that's going to just support the plant as it grows will really help.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd like to also talk about some of the health problems with this particular plant. It can be frustrating sometimes. Look, aphids, yes, we can use our wide all. I don't want to go too deeply into that. But sometimes it gets these like crispy brown parts on the leaves. And it can be really frustrating for people who don't know what to do with that. What do you do about that and what causes that?
Well, sometimes you see people posting pictures of plants and they've recently bought them and they've got all these black patches on the leaves. It's quite a common scenario. And oftentimes that's because you don't know what's happened to that plant before you've bought it. And quite often the plant might have been left in a cold place and those black patches are basically cold damage. I see that quite a lot. Possibly not so much in your climate, but it's something that does happen. So damage that's occurred before you bought the plant and when you bring it home, it starts to turn up on the leaves. That's kind of annoying because that damage is not going to go away. The leaf will eventually be replaced by other leaves, but that damage is there for good. The other thing, if you've got straw-like patches, it may be that you've moved your plant into somewhere where there's just too much sun. So we're at, you know, in both our hemispheres, we're at the sort of cusp of a change in the seasons, and your plant might be fine in a particular spot for half of the year, but then as the sunlight increases, it's going to get burnt. So, you know, it's worth thinking about that. If you're getting straw-like marks on the leaves, that can be a sign the leaves are getting burnt. And then with the other thing you might find is that you get kind of crispy bits on your leaves. And oftentimes this can be that the plant is just getting a little bit stressed because it's not quite in the right conditions at root level. So again, it all goes back to the roots. If you've got a variegated Swiss cheese plant, the creamy parts of the leaf often will end up going brown. And again, it just means that you haven't quite got conditions absolutely perfect. It might be any number of different factors. It's just one of those things. Your leaves are not going to look absolutely perfect. But with the crispy bits on green leaves, usually, as I say, you're either, you know, underwatering, overwatering. You're not quite meeting the plant's needs. And the main thing is just to get in there, down into the soil and check what's going on. I'm always kind of reluctant to repot these plants because they're just so big and heavy once they get large. But actually, it's really important to be doing that and to be checking the roots and seeing what's going on. Because as I say, you can get these really thick roots that will fill a pot in no time. And then at that point, the plant really has nowhere to go for any more nutrients. And so it does often result in the leaves starting to deteriorate a bit. So it's really a question of kind of keeping an eye on it and watching out for what's going on. The other thing that you're always checking for with anything developing on the leaves in terms of marks is pests. And, you know, Monstras can be subject to a number of different pests. I've had an issue with scale on mine, and which is actually on the Swiss cheese plant, not that traumatic. They're quite easy to remove. You just there's a really good tip from a guy called Daryl Cheng in Canada, which is you basically get a bit of sticky tape and you just apply that to the leaves and the scale comes away quite nicely. But you also get things like thrips and you could get red spider mites, but usually those pests will only proliferate when the plant is a little bit stressed anyway. And that leaves it open to attack from things like this. So if you can keep the plant healthy, then hopefully the rest will follow.
Okay. I personally love using white oil just to put a little bit, mix it up in a bit of bucket of water and get a wipe, and then you wipe it over the leaves. And I actually find that makes the leaves look quite nice as well, like they have a nice sheen on them. Would you recommend that?
I don't know what white oil is. Is this a cultural difference? Is it like horticultural oil?
Or yeah, basically.
Yeah, okay. I personally would not – I mean, yeah, you can – there are concoctions that are based with that contain horticultural oil to treat pests, and they work really, really well. I never put anything on the leaves in terms of if I'm just wanting them to clean nicely. I tend to avoid putting things on the leaves just to make them shine. Not because it's going to cause any massive damage, particularly if you're using horticultural oil. I wouldn't recommend using things like people say mayonnaise and coconut oil. I would only ever use horticultural oil. But I kind of try to my attitude is that we've got this idea that plants have to have really shiny leaves, and actually most plants don't have really shiny leaves. And there's probably a reason for that. So I kind of try to tend to enjoy the natural look of the leaves. But yeah, if you're doing a pest treatment, of course, that might have a dual purpose there.
Would you ever worry about, with the sticky tape, taking the cuticle or the waxy layer off the leaf?
You know what? I've done it on various plants. I would only do it on this kind of plant. I wouldn't do it on, right. For example, I also had scale on some more, much more fragile leaved houseplants, and I would never use that, this particular method, on them. On the leathery leaves of a mature monstera, on leaves that have hardened off and are not just newly emerged, it's absolutely fine. Right. You use, the tape I usually use is paper parcel tape. So it's got some stick, but it's not like, you know, right. Nuclear strength duct tape or anything.
Yeah.
And for me, that works really well. And I haven't seen any leaf damage as a result of that. It just lifts those scale away. And the thing to remember about scale is that, and it's actually true with all, pretty much all pests, is we see the scale and we think, oh gosh, there's a scale. And we remove that and think we've solved the problem. But actually a lot of the life cycle stages of those pests are actually too small for us to see with our regular human eyes. So we might have taken off that scale, but there might be youngster scales moving around the leaf that we haven't yet spotted. So this tape also helps to just remove those. And I would also combine that with taking the plant outside and spraying it down using some kind of spray. Like here we have something called SB Plant Invigorator, which is kind of has a physical impact on pests on the leaves. And just keep, the main thing is with all these pests is just keep repeating, because you will not catch them all. Any pests, but particularly scale, like to hang out in odd places on the leaf, and then you spot them. So you've just got to be really persistent. But yeah, I've never had any problems with damage, but it is one to use cautiously. If you do have a much more fragile leaf, the tape is just going to rip that plant apart.
Yeah. So in that, I think we call it masking tape. I think we're talking about the same thing there. So that's very fine, very loosely sticky. Yeah.
Yeah, I've used masking tape. I've used paper parcel tape. I have actually used duct tape with no problems on it as well. And I've used regular sticky tape. So it really doesn't seem to cause any problems. As I say, just beware the very, very young, tender leaves as they, you know, the new leaves of the monstera, as they emerge, they're like a sort of a butterfly coming out of a pupa, and they gradually harden off. So those leaves are much more delicate and can be damaged more easily, so I would leave those ones alone.
Wonderful. Now we've got a bunch of other plants to talk about, but before we move on, there's one tip that I always see on the internet in terms of like forums, like Facebook groups, and on Reddit especially r/plants, and that's, they always say that the monsteras need to have moisture sprayed on the leaves, or they need humidity. Is that a myth, or is that true?
Well, I mean, yeah, they'll be quite happy having a nice boost of humidity for sure. You're probably looking at your plant being a bit happier and growing a bit faster. However, they, as I said earlier, you know, they grow in a vast range of kind of climates, and so they can cope with dry air. They will be absolutely fine in dry air. And I sometimes, I was having a discussion with somebody recently where I was saying, well, I don't actually want my houseplants to grow super fast and grow as massive as they can get, because my house isn't that big. if my monstera goes enormous, I'm going to hack it back. So I'm not one of these people who's like, oh yeah, my monstera's thrown out another 5 leaves this week, you know, because actually I don't want that to happen. I want it to grow slowly. So I'm not going to be repotting it all the time. I'm not going to necessarily be trying to maximize growth. For me, like if you've got an enormous house and a very high ceilings, go for it. But for me, I'm not necessarily trying to make it have optimal conditions, because that for me is just adding to my workload, really. But yeah, moisture in the air is good. And, you know, it comes from Mexico and Guatemala. Those are places that have humid air. But this is why it's a really popular houseplant, because it will grow in 20% humidity. It may get a little bit crispy. It may be a little bit unhappy, but it's not going to die.
So will that actually give the crispy leaves, like the dry, dead, necrotic parts on the leaf, or is that not the cause?
Well, I mean, that is more to do with what's going on at root level, and these things can be connected. But if your plant is in very dry air and it's in a warm room, obviously it's going to be transpiring really fast, and you're going to be losing moisture from the soil quite quickly. So again, it's all to do with what's happening at root level, and the dry air will contribute to that. But it's just keeping an eye on that substrate that is really, really key. And you know, you can do things to help with humidity. I wouldn't say spraying the leaves all the time is particularly helpful. It's going to have a negligible effect on air humidity in the room. You'll be better off, taking a hygrometer around your house and finding the most humid room and putting it there, and also doing things like, using a humidifier if you want to, or sticking some dishes of water around your plant, sticking it on a pebble tray. Those kind of things have quite a small impact on humidity, but will help a little bit. But, you know, if you've got a hygrometer, use it, and just be aware of when air humidity is dropping, particularly if your heating's coming on, that's going to produce a dry air situation. But yeah, these plants, they're very, very tough. They're not like, you know, an alocasia or something where they're going to immediately get really grumpy about a bit of dry air. That's why people grow them and enjoy them.
Yeah. And actually, I think a lot of philodendrons and also pothos have sort of similar care needs, wouldn't you say? Other aroids, not necessarily those like alocasias, like you said, they're a bit fussier. But yeah, some of those well-loved indoor plants like your pothos and your monsteras and your philodendrons, like they're all quite similar.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, Philodendron heteraceum is a really, you know, tough plant also. And also Devil's Ivy, Epipremnum aureum, similar. These are the tough plants that you see, you know, in barbers and Chinese takeaways and offices, because they are really, really tough. And there's a reason why they're so popular. And it's because they are very, very flexible and they don't have particularly strict care needs. So yeah, they're all good choices if you are the kind of person where you just feel everything you buy, when you buy something from the plant store, it just dies, then try one of these. It would be a good option.
Wonderful. All right, now I'd like to move on to another one. The next one we have on our list is Begonia lucerna. So why this particular begonia, and why do you love this plant so much?
So this is there's begonias, right? Indoor or outdoor gardener, you're going to know about begonias. There's a absolute, so many begonia species that we grow. And this is within the begonia genus, this is one of the cane begonias. So it grows quite tall and it has these sort of bamboo-like stems, and these beautiful angel wing-shaped leaves with silvery markings on it, and also beautiful flowers as well. So I think this is a really classic plant. It's one of those sort of heritage plants that you might find in, you know, your nan's house or your auntie's house that they've had for like 50 years. It's an easy begonia. So compared to something like Rex begonia, this is a much easier plant to grow. Mm-hmm. The only time people have a problem with it is when it's little and it's a tiny little plant. That is when things can go wrong. But once it's mature, it is super tough and just a real beauty that you can have for absolutely years in your house. And that's, for me, is one of the qualifications that makes a really good houseplant. It's something that is going to be a long-term resident in your home, not something you're going to have for 6 months, but something that's going to last and that you can propagate and hand cuttings onto other people. To me, that makes it a really good houseplant.
I love that. And also the other thing about this plant is that it flowers. So when we talk about indoor plants, usually we think that we have to sacrifice on flowers. So do you need a lot of light for this begonia to flower?
It's one of those ones where it's what they're always described as bright indirect light. I mean, who the heck knows what that means? But, you know, again, it will cope with a lot of light. And you'll be able to see from looking at the leaves whether the plant is, you know, maybe getting too much light. You know, the leaves go very, very pale, or you get, you know, strawy marks on there again. It may be getting too much light. But I mean, almost always with houseplants, people say, oh, you know, how much light does this need? And I say, probably more than you're giving it. That's usually the answer. If you put this in a part of your house where you can't read with no light on, it's way too dark. Wow. Way too dark.
Put a pothos there.
So think about that when you're positioning this and really any houseplant. But I just think it's, as you say, the flowers are beautiful and you get this amazing foliage as well. Again, one of the things with this one is it can grow huge, but you can chop this back. And I'd also say this for the Monstera. These are plants that are absolutely happy to be hacked back every now and again. So you can kind of keep them within bounds of however you want to keep them, whether you want to let them grow massive or keep them quite compact. You can cut them back. They respond really well to that.
Yeah, so that I like that too. We like these low fuss plants that can survive in multiple different environments. So I think the next one that we have to talk about is another aroid, and that's the Aspidistra. So we call this the cast iron plant over in Australia. I'm not sure if it gets the same name over there, but the species we want to talk about today is Alatior or Alatium. I'm sorry, my Latin is horrible.
Well, this is really, again, a classic houseplant that has certainly in the UK has a lot of sort of historical interest, really, because it's something that we've been growing and loving, and the Victorians absolutely adored this plant. And the reason why they adored it is because it is just so tolerant of polluted air, cold air, drafts, and not a lot of light. So that's a big one, because obviously Victorian homes were considerably colder than our homes today. So that's one of the reasons why this was a popular plant in Victoria times. It's coming back, though. It's not an aroid. It's a member of the asparagus family. Which a lot of people don't realize. And it is grows it where it grows in the wild. It grows under trees in dry shade, generally. So it has quite a lot of ability to survive in lower light conditions. Even this plant, though, if you shove it in the darkest core of your house, is going to be unhappy. But if you put it in a hallway where it's got, you know, cold drafts and far from optimal conditions, it will just sit there and be fine. It's not one that you're growing for the flowers. Flowers are actually, I think botanists call them cryptic, because they emerge at ground level, and they're these little curious sort of purple, they're quite fascinating actually, little purple round nobbles that emerge around the base of the plant. And people used to think they were pollinated by slugs, but they're actually pollinated by fungus gnats, funnily enough, which is ironic given how much houseplant growers tend to hate fungus gnats. But this is a plant, as I say, that sort of has come back into fashion. It's quite expensive to buy is one of the downsides. And the reason for that is because it's slow growing and it's not something you can kind of chop and prop extensively and make lots of new plants really quickly. But again, I love it because it's an heirloom plant that you can say, well, I'm going to have this now. And in 100 years time, my kids and kids' kids can have it too, because it will last that long. And, I just love a plant that can do that. There are also some variegated cultivars of this plant. The only problem with those is that if you do have your plant in quite a dark corner, the variegation tends to fade. So that's a problem, but it's a great indoor-outdoor plant. It will grow well outdoors here in the climate of the UK, which is, so it can go down to well below freezing and it's absolutely fine. So it's a toughie, a real toughie.
So I love a good toughie. I feel like this next one, we might be leaving the low fuss plants a little bit, or just in terms of like the ones that look amazing all year round. We're going to talk about moth orchids now, and please forgive me if my Latin fails me here, but is it, do you pronounce it Phalaenopsis?
Correct. Yes. Well, ooh. I mean, you can pronounce it any way you like, but yeah, that's generally the pronunciation. Yeah. I mean, we have to have these in the list because the numbers of these plants sold around the world must be into the millions, billions. I don't know. They're just absolutely enormously popular. I'm sure it's the same where you are.
Oh, absolutely.
You walk into a supermarket and there's just racks of them on sale.
And some of them look great and some of them don't.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's personal choice. Whether you like the style of the flowers and the leaves. I mean, one of the things that I really gets my goat is staking. So when you buy one of these things, they always are staked and the leaves, the flower stems are held in place with stakes and little butterfly clips. And the first thing I do when I get one of those orchids is take the stakes out because I want to see them flop. I want to see them naturally doing their thing how they would in the wild. I mean, it's worth saying that the breeding of these species, there's in the genus of Phalaenopsis, there's a lot of species that have been bred extensively to create the plants that we buy today. I mean, the breeding has just been absolutely incredible. And so they've bred in lots of qualities that are great. But it does mean that these plants are quite removed from what we would be seeing in the wild growing in Southeast Asia, but they've got a lot of the characteristics that make them really great houseplants. And that is, unlike the Hespidistra, these plants absolutely love the conditions of the average kind of home. So they, like us, they love the same things we do. Steady temperature of around 20 degrees centigrade. They're not really bothered by dry air. So that makes them a good house plant. And, you know, the flowers are really long-lived, will last for a very long time. And, you know, they're quite hard to kill. Even people who are truly neglecting these plants can keep them alive. So that's why they're so popular. Sadly, a lot of people do throw them away once they finish flowering, though. So I'm always keen to encourage people to actually nurture them and get more flowers out of them.
So that was something I did want to ask you about this plant. So, like, I've heard of a lot of indoor gardeners saying, like, they keep their moth orchids on rotation and, you know, they'll put them somewhere that's less visible once that flowering finishes because they say, yes, the leaves are pretty, but really why I like these orchids is for the flowers and they aren't always in flower. Or can you sort of encourage them to continuously stay in flower? Do I have that wrong?
Well, the best way of getting a moth orchid to flower is just by treating it as well as you possibly can. So the flower spikes emerge from between the leaves and that flower spike the flowers will last for however long. The better you're taking care of that plant, the better the flowers will be. But inevitably, eventually those flowers are going to die back. Mm. And in order for the plant to produce more flowers, it has to produce more leaves because you won't get another flower spike emerging from the same point on the stem. The next flower spike will probably be three or four leaves higher up the stem. So you've got to concentrate on getting good growth on the foliage side in order to get more flowers. So really just it's a question of just treating them really nicely. In the past, people used to sort of say, oh, well, you need to give them a day-night differential in temperature to get them to flower. And that may still be partly true, the idea being that triggers the plant to think about flowering if it's getting a little bit colder at night than it is during the day. However, the breeding that I spoke about has been so extensive that it's kind of a moot point whether that makes any difference anymore. Okay. So it's right. really a case of just looking after your plant as well as you can. And as I say, if you've got a few, then hopefully you'll find that you have something in flower most of the time. Often, though, they do synchronize and, you know, flower together. But yeah, I mean, also just try to appreciate the beauty of the leaves. If you're looking after the leaves well, then there's something to admire in those leaves too.
Okay, so I want to ask you a couple of things. Are these myths? So one, orchid roots like to photosynthesize, so you'll get a better result if you have them in a clear pot. Is that a fact or a myth?
Well, it's true that the roots photosynthesize. So because this plant is an epiphyte growing in trees in Southeast Asia in the wild, those roots have evolved to photosynthesize. So that's why they're pale green color. And it's a useful indication of whether your plant needs water. If you look at those roots and if they look very, very silvery, usually that means the plant is very dry. If they're pale green and plump, the plant has enough moisture, but they are photosynthesizing. They have a substance called velamen on the outside of those roots. And so that's traditionally why orchids are sold in clear plastic pots. The idea being that you can see the roots and that the roots can get some light. Now, if you put them in a pot, a cash pot, a cover pot that is opaque, it's not the end of the world, provided your plant, you know, is being cared for reasonably well and has a decent amount of light. The fact that those roots are not getting a lot of light will not be a massive problem. And you could pot them into an orchid pot. You get these specialist orchid pots with made of terracotta with lots of holes. Again, that's fine. But the joy of the clear plastic pot is it allows you to see what the roots are doing, how moist the substrate is, and that just allows you very quickly to assess whether your plant needs watering or not. So, yeah, that is true. That is true. But the clear plastic pot thing is a bit of a personal choice.
Okay, so they're still going to flower even if you don't have them in a clear plastic pot. And you also do see the roots coming out of the top a lot of the time too, and they look quite beautiful when they do that.
Yeah, and that's absolutely fine. That would be what would be happening in nature. The roots are not all going to be, you know, buried underground. They're going to be visible. And so enjoy the beauty of the roots, and that's part of the effect of the plant.
Love it. Okay, so they're also quite fussy about the substrate that you put them in, are they not?
Yeah, so with orchids, it's pretty simple. I mean, it's not complicated, but it is different from other houseplants. They are usually potted into chipped bark of various grades depending on the size of the plant. So if you've got one of the very tiny mini moth orchids, then it's in a quite a fine grade of bark. But if you've got one of the real big ones, then it's probably in quite a coarse grade of bark. And it's a great substrate for them. It means that they're very the substrate is extremely free draining, echoing what they'd be experiencing in a tree. You know, lots of rainfall and then the water draining away really fast. People do also grow them in other things as well, like expanded clay pebbles. Lecca is another thing that people can grow them in. That works really, really well. I think also some people grow them in sphagnum moss and rock wool. Again, perfectly good as long as you've kind of tuned into the nature of that substrate. Sphagnum moss obviously holds on to a lot of moisture. And one other thing to say about moth orchids, if you buy one, it's really worth having a close look at your plant, because sometimes they are sold now with sort of planted into a plug, either of sphagnum moss or of rich organic material. And if that happens and you aren't incredibly careful with the watering, that can cause root rot. So I always advise people, check what's going on under the roots when you buy your plant. And if it does have one of these plugs, remove it and pot it up in pure bark. And that way it'll be much easier to keep the moisture levels right for those roots.
You see it all the time in sphagnum moss. I see it all the time. And it's especially easy to see because they come in the little cachet pots or cash pots, as you say, and you can pull them out and you can see straight through that clear plastic in a tub. But You know, what do we need to keep in mind in terms of like when we're reporting? Because it can be quite nerve-wracking. You know, you don't want to damage those roots. And like, how fussy do we need to be? Like, how sturdy are they? Are they going to be able to take it?
They're really sturdy. I would be a lot less worried repotting this than I would a house plant with very fine, fragile roots. These are meaty old roots, and you can really like get in there, and it's, you know, it's not a problem. They are tough. And so you don't really need to repot until the roots are really busting out of the existing pot is one thing to say. When that happens though, and you see you've got a mass of roots coming out the top and, you know, the pot's full of roots, it's time to repot. And bear in mind also that over time, the bark will degrade. And if you see the bark sort of starting to break down, so it looks more like soil than bark, again, it's time to just wash off everything off the roots, give them a good clean, and then repot in something, in some fresh bark. But yeah, they're easy to deal with because those roots are so tough. And likewise, the leaves, you know, you're not going to be easily damaging the leaves when you're working with them because they are really leathery and tough.
And so when we're putting those pots in the new pot, do we just kind of like dangle the roots in there and then sort of pour bark around it? Is that how you would do it?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's sometimes a question of just sometimes I'll do it and then look at it and go, no, that hasn't worked.
Try again.
And the good thing about it is it's easy to pull it all out and start again because it's a different kind of proposition than dealing with, you know, a soil-based substrate. So yeah, just try to get the roots in the right position, fill in with the bark. And if you use bark that you've already dampened, then that helps as well because the plant will immediately be getting moisture. And just have a fiddle around with it until you're happy with how it looks. Doesn't matter if there's a few roots coming over the top, but also just make sure that when you're examining the plant, have a pair of sterile scissors or snips around. And if you do see any roots that have kind of gone wizened or rotted away or died off, just chop those away. And the reason why I say sterilized is because orchids are very prone to passing on viruses from one plant to another. So you do want to sterilize your equipment between different plants.
Okay,
and I just do that quite simply by just running the thing under the blades and over my hob, a naked flame, a match, lighter, whatever. Just a few seconds under there, that means they're nice and sterile for the next use.
Great, love that. So I love the flame idea too, instead of using, you know, metho or something like that.
Yeah, you can. I mean, you can use any of those, but it's just, for me, it's just convenience. It's just like quick to flip on the hob.
They're dry.
There you go. Job done.
Yeah, love it. What about feeding moth orchids? Are they fussy with food or do they need a certain NPK ratio?
Yeah, they are really quite actually a bit like, in a weird way, a bit like cacti and succulents in that their nutrient needs are quite low, but you do need to use a specialist orchid feed. It doesn't really matter which one. There's loads of ones on the market. You know, they will go for a long time without being fed. And oftentimes people say, well, I've had this orchid for 10 years and I've never fed it. And it's like, well, there you go. They don't need a lot of nutrients. But if you do want to get the best out of them, just pick up an orchid feed and it sounds so basic, but just read the instructions and follow the instructions.
Take it back to basics.
Yeah, it's really like it's amazing how many people say, well, I don't know what it says on the bottle. Well, read that first and then work it out from there. And just that way you'll get the best out of your plants. And at a push, you can just use regular houseplant compost, but use it in a very dilute form if you can't get hold of any orchid feed. But yeah, they're not, their nutrient needs are quite small, actually. They're pretty clever plants.
Love that. Okay, so this is another one that is difficult for me to pronounce the scientific name. I call it the ponytail plant, but it can also go by Bocarnia recurvata. So how close
Good
did I
job.
Get with that one? Did I?
Okay, you absolutely fine. As I say,
phonetics.
As long as I can understand you, it's absolutely fine. Yeah. So this plant I really love, and this is one that I recommend for people who've got a lot of sun, but they want a big statement plant. So maybe a situation where they've got too much sun, even for a Swiss cheese plant, you could buy a really nice big ponytail palm and it would absolutely love it in a really sunny spot. So that's, if you're in that situation, this is a good plant to know about.
Mm-hmm. So is this one, would you say this one's a fussy one, or would you say this one's a bit more, a little bit more of a, barber plant?
Well, this one is, it's a member of, well, it's what we would call a cordiciform plant, which is just a name, another word for a plant with a kind of a swollen stem or root. Mm. And it, one of its other names is elephant's foot, because the base of the plant is really swollen. And then you get this woody stem, and then at the top, this kind of top knot of strappy leaves. It's really cool looking. But that swollen stem is obviously serving a purpose. And the purpose it's serving is just storing loads of moisture. It's another Mexican plant. So it will cope with dry periods and draw on the moisture and nutrients that it has stored. As I say, if you buy a big specimen of this, I remember when I first started, when I was working at the Guardian newspaper, they had some massive, massive 6 foot tall ponytail palms. And I was always so jealous of these plants. So if you can afford to buy a really big one, then they're super, super, super easy. Not a problem at all. You just need to give them loads of light and chuck some water at them occasionally. The way you're going to struggle is if you've got not enough light and you're giving them too much water, particularly in winter. You do not want that fat stem to start rotting or the roots to start rotting. So again, it goes back to substrate, making sure they're in a really free draining mix. That way you're making sure that the plant will hopefully avoid root rot and just hectons of light. So again, if you've got that beautiful massive sunny window, this could be a really good choice. I've got quite a small one which I've been growing, which I bought as a teeny tiny plant, and I'm like, oh gosh, probably by the time my children are retiring this might be a massive plant. But it's a real fun one. And I think the cordiciforms are a kind of a Marmite thing, in that some people are just like, oh no, that's weird. And some people love them, but I think they're really cool.
I love them too. They're amazing. And look, another one that's going to suffer from root rot, and we could not have this episode without talking about this one, is Crassula ovata. So this is like probably the first plant that a lot of people think of when they think of the word succulent.
Mm. Absolutely. This is a really good succulent. And one of the reasons why it's a good succulent actually is that it is able to cope with a lot more organic material in its soil than some of the other members of the succulent family. It's quite tolerant of a little bit more moisture around the roots. And it's also not a plant that is going to get terribly leggy and etiolated if it is given lower light conditions than ideal. So that makes it a good succulent, because a lot of succulents like echeverias, people buy them and then they don't give them enough light, they give them too much water, and they either rot or they turn into a firework and stretch right out.
And you really notice when those ones start etiolating, whereas Crassula already have a bit of gap between the leaves.
Yeah, exactly. With the Crassula, if you're a bit of a Crassula nut, you're probably going to look at a plant and go, oh yeah, that's a little bit stretched, but it's not going to look really dramatic. Generally, they can cope with that lower light. I say lower light, still give them tons of light, but if you're not able to give them tons of sun, they'll still be okay. And as I say, they aren't so likely to have root rot. Still it can be still an issue, but I've seen Crassula ovatas planted in garden soil I've seen all kinds of things where people have these plants for years and it's planted in not ideal stuff and they're still going strong. So
you're so right. I've seen them planted in heavy clay before, now that I think of it.
Yeah, absolutely. They will tolerate all kinds of things. And the other thing to say about them is that they can grow quite big, and they can, if you have them for a few decades, you will get a tree. You know, this is a South African tree that grows, I think, you know, up to about 3 to 5 meters tall. So it can get quite large. The interesting thing about this tree is that it doesn't have the defense mechanisms that some other succulents have. So it doesn't stop itself being eaten with spines or with like furry leaves that aren't very palatable. It actually kind of makes a bit of a feature out of being edible in that the plant is incredibly quick to root. So if, say it's being eaten by something, and obviously there's a bit of mess, some leaves fall to the ground or parts of leaves, and they will root and grow into a new plant. So this plant kind of takes advantage of the fact that it's being eaten to spread around. And it's also the when it gets really big, like, you know, like 3 meters tall, the branches are quite fragile. And so when there's like high winds, branches can fall, and again the plant then makes, you know, roots and turns into a new plant. So it's quite clever. And you can end up with quite a large plant. You quite often see here in the UK, on Facebook Marketplace, people trying to sell large jade trees that have outgrown their space for a lot of money. I don't know if anyone ever manages to sell those, because lots of people just don't have the space for a massive plant, but they do get quite big. And then you've got the issue of, okay, taking it outside for the summer, bringing it in the winter, possibly. If you've got a massive conservatory, though, it shouldn't be a problem. But yeah, it can be a biggie.
Yeah, there was one particular Crassula ovata plant that I used to maintain in an aged care facility, and they'd planted it right next to their door, and it had been hedged pruned for so long, and you could see the leaves sprouting up everywhere, even within the hedge itself, and so there's so much material coming out, and, you know, the budgets are low, so you can never really get in there and give it a good prune out and do what you really want with it. But this plant, the stem was thicker than my leg. It was huge.
Yeah. They do get really big, and it's a wonderful thing when that happens, but not everyone obviously can cope with a plant that that big, or wants to cope with a plant that big.
Well, just hedge prune it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, yeah, people sort of spend a lot of time worrying about pruning house plants, but actually, particularly with this kind of plant, it, you know, like just run into it a few times and a few bits will fall off, and then exactly, it'll be fine.
So every cut you make has a consequence. If you want to keep it that natural shape, just cut it down to a branch, to a fork, or if you want it to bush up, just tip prune at the tips and it'll become more bushy.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you just look at it, observe. I mean, whenever I'm sort of thinking about cutting back houseplants, you know, it's just like an apple tree. You're going to just stand back and look at it and think about what you're trying to achieve and, you know, do it in a mindful way. And don't do too much at once if you're worried about the overall look. But yeah, it's the same things as pruning outside. And that way you'll end up with lots of material that you can also propagate. So yeah, it's a win-win.
Okay, now I'm excited about this plant. This is a really beautiful plant. I love this plant so much, particularly when it's in flower. Can you tell us about Hoya carnosa?
Yeah, well, this is from your part of the world. so a lot of Hoya species are Australian natives, parts of Australia anyway. Obviously, it's a large place. Hoya carnosa, again, I mean, I'm sounding a bit like a broken record here, but again, it's one of these plants that will last a really long time. And I'm pleased to say it has come back into fashion after being a bit of a kind of one of those plants that people say, oh yeah, your granny has one, it's not very trendy. Now Hoyas, I think, are coming up alongside aroids as being these kind of trendy plants of the moment. But I love Hoyas because they're the double whammy of beautiful foliage and flowers as well. And the flowers are really interesting and curious to look at. And it's a toughie that will adapt to a lot of different conditions. And there's also, in the case of Hoya carnosa, loads and loads of interesting cultivars of this plant too. So, you know, from ones with beautiful variegated leaves, different leaf forms, So you could just collect Huaconosa and fill your house with those if you wanted to.
Yeah, they have this beautiful texture on the flowers too. How would you describe it? Would you say it's velvety?
Yeah, it's kind of fuzzy, like these pink fuzzy flowers, which are very curious and really detailed. And interestingly, they are pollinated by moths. They are pollinated by moths at night. So nectar production in these flowers peaks at nighttime when they attract in these beautiful owl moths. And, researchers actually sort of sat there night after night seeing which insects were coming in to pollinate, and then ended up finding out that the main pollinators were these owl moths. And the way they found that was by when the owl moth comes into the flower, it ends up picking up these pollen sacs on its legs and then going to another plant. The pollen sacs get deposited, and then there's this little clip-like structure is left behind on the legs. So they were able to count the numbers of these clip-like structures to see how successful the moth had been at pollinating the plant, and it was indeed very successful. So it's a really beautiful flower that peaks out at nighttime, but unlike something like the beautiful night blooming orchid cactus, these flowers last a good few days rather than just a one night. So and Huaconosa, the scent is not that strong. There are other Hoya species that have beautifully scented flowers, and everyone has a slightly different interpretation of the scent. But yeah, I think they are a real delight to have, and you get a lot of flowers. The only other thing to say about the flowers, which sometimes throws people off, is the flowers are produced on little parts of the plant called peduncles. And a peduncle, it looks a bit like the end of a burned cigarette. And the peduncle is a permanent feature of the plant. So when the flowers have fallen off, the peduncle stays there. And you need to make sure that you don't cut the peduncle off, because that will set back the plant's flowering. So that's worth knowing.
There you go. So how do you prune it then if you need to? Like, let's say the flowers are dry, where would you prune it to?
Yeah, it's a tricky one, because if you need to prune it, you might be taking off some peduncles. The other thing that's worth saying with Hoyas is people get very panicky, because the way that it grows is producing a stem which will probably have no leaves on it. And you look at it and think, oh, that's how that I'm going to prune that away because there's no leaves on it. But actually, that is how the plant grows without using up too much energy. So this is again another epiphyte, and the stem goes out bare and starts seeking out something to anchor onto, and it can actually move around quite a lot in a search for a branch, and only once it's found something to anchor to will it start putting out leaves. So lots of people go, oh well, I'm going to cut this off because there's no leaves on it. But oftentimes it's just because it's not tied into anything, and so the leaves haven't emerged. So that's the first thing to say. Don't cut off those bare stems. Give them a chance to actually anchor to something, and the leaves should follow. If you are pruning it back, look for stems that don't have peduncles on them. But again, you might eventually, if you've got a really rampant plant, have to cut back. And I would always try to save the peduncles if you can, but you might have to lose some along the way. The plant can be covered in peduncles if it's a successful plant. And so sometimes you might just need to keep them pruned back a bit, because they can get quite rampant and grow up a trellis or an obelisk and cover it quite quickly. The other thing you can do if you don't want to prune is just keep kind of swirling it round your support and tying it in, and you'll end up with a really sort of lush, thick effect without having to prune too much.
Okay, so would you say just leave the flowers, like just don't prune it unless you absolutely have to?
Well, it's a personal choice thing. Yeah. I mean, if you've got a really kind of heritage heirloom specimen that's been in your family for a really long time, you may find that occasionally you need to give it a really big haircut just because it's getting so massive. They do get huge. They can, you know, easily, if you gave them a 12 foot of trellis to go up, they would easily go up those over time. But so you might get to the point where you've got to cut it back just to keep it in bounds. But if you don't need to do that, I would just keep winding it round, keep tying it in and letting it get more and more bushy. That way, I always think it looks amazing that way. But it's a real personal choice. Again, you know, any pruning will obviously prompt new growth. So if you do have a plant that's kind of just one spindly stem, sometimes you can just be brutal and give it a hack back. And that should hopefully, usually you'll get lots of new growth coming out from the side shoots and from the base as well.
Okay. So now we're moving on to a plant that I personally don't have a whole lot of experience with. And this is a Latin name that I might be going to butcher here. But Aeschynanthus, is that how you pronounce it?
Oh, yeah, this is a good one. This is a good one. So, yeah, I mean, for many years I grew this and I had no idea how to say that name. It is pronounced Aeschynanthus.
Okay.
It doesn't look like that, but it's a word, it's a letter salad that you're dealing with, but it's Aeschynanthus, member of the Gesneriad family. So the same family as African violets and Streptocarpus, right, but a plant that looks quite different. And yes, again, I'm a bit of a cheerleader for this plant because I think it's quite underappreciated, but the Aeschynanthus genus is a really lovely one. And there's some beautiful plants in there that are definitely worth growing and knowing about.
Okay. So why do you love this plant so much? Just because it's uncommon, or is there another reason? Or it does look quite beautiful when I Google it.
Yeah, it's a very beautiful, often mainly, I don't know, probably somebody's going to pick me out and say, well, there are some that don't trail, but mainly trailing a genus of plants. And they're all kind of subtropical, tropical plants in this Gesneria family. And, you know, probably you might know it as the lipstick vine because some of the species, or most of the species, have these flowers that look a bit like I guess a tube of lipstick. I guess that's why it's called that.
But
there's a few different ones that I really enjoy. Probably the one you will have seen is the Aeschynanthus twister is quite a popular one, where you get these twisty leaves and then these bright red flowers. There's another one called Aeschynanthus Black Pagoda that I absolutely love, that has these very dark, leathery, marbled leaves, which are really beautiful. And then the flowers on that are kind of orange and red. Really, really nice plant. That's a really good one. And again, just tough, just really, really tough and beautiful and easy to grow. I don't know why they aren't more popular. I can't explain it.
So how do they go with flowering indoors? Because when you Google this plant, and I will spell it in a second for people, so get your phones ready for it just in a minute. But, you know, they look quite prolific in their flowering. Is that always the case if they're indoors, or do they really need a lot of sunlight to get like that?
Mine seem to flower according to their own sweet schedule. I never quite know when the flowers are coming. Okay. But with most of them, they're beautiful enough that when you don't have the flowers, you're just enjoying the foliage, because the foliage is beautiful as well. So that's quite a nice thing. I do like these plants, as you're probably guessing, that have kind of double duty, because they are producing this beautiful foliage as well. I'm just trying to think. My black pagoda, for example, has been flowering now for probably about a couple of months. But I've got other Aeschynanthus that were flowering in the spring that have stopped. I think they're one of these flowers that can come sporadically through the year, rather than just having a very, very set flowering time. But I just think they're so much fun. And yeah, just a really nice plant to enjoy, that probably you're going to find relatively easy to care for if you're going for one of the well-known popular species. I should say there are members of the Aeschynanthus genus. You know, it's quite a big genus, over 100 species. There are some, obviously, that are quite specialist, and you wouldn't want to kind of just thrust upon a houseplant beginner. I don't grow any of those either. But, you know, if you're getting something from the garden store, then it's going to be one of the regular ones, and you'll find that it's fairly easy to care for.
Okay. So if anyone would like to Google this plant, it's AESCHYNANTHUS, Escananthus. So there we go.
Yeah. I mean, gosh, I don't know why it's been given such a difficult name, but.
Oh, yeah. Latin.
Perhaps that's why it's not very popular.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe we just need to call it the lipstick plant. Maybe that'll make it more popular.
Mm-hmm.
Although we do have a couple of plants to do with lips. Whenever I hear lipstick, I just go straight to hot lips, salvia.
Yeah, that's true. Yes. I don't know whether. I don't think the flowers look particularly like lipsticks. I suppose they're just red. Basically, that's what it is.
It needs a rebrand.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, so the next one is saxifrage. Saxifraga stolonifera. Stolonifera.
Yes. I'm probably being a little bit of a, what's the word? I'm probably being a little bit out there by choosing this as one of the best houseplants. And a lot of people are probably going to disagree with me about this, but I'm standing by it because I think it's awesome.
It is beautiful.
Yeah, it's really beautiful. And again, it's another really underrated houseplant. I mean, I should say, I would justify my choice by saying, you know, this is a really old houseplant. This has been grown in people's windows since the 1750s here in the UK. So, like, this has been around. It's not going anywhere. It may not be that popular, but I'm just going to keep growing it anyway. It is a bit like so many of the houseplants we love in that it's a prolific mother. So it produces lots of babies on stolons, hence the specific epithet stolonifera. So it produces these very, very thin, wiry stolons on the end of which you find baby plants, which I guess look a bit like strawberry runners. And that's why people call it the strawberry saxifrage.
Okay.
And you can get a lovely sort of jellyfish style effect from growing lots of these stolons on your plant. And it also flowers early summer. You get a lovely display of little white flowers on stems held above the plant, the rosette of the plant. I just think it's a really lovely plant. And if you are the kind of person who tends to give cacti and succulents way too much water, give this a try because this actually likes being moist all the time.
The foliage is slightly reminiscent on some of the cultivars, to me anyway, of a begonia. Would you agree or disagree with that, just in terms of the visual?
Yeah, it is. And that's why people call it the strawberry begonia. And again, strawberry geranium is the other name. The leaves are sort of geranium shaped. Yeah. Unfortunately, all these common names are not that helpful because then people think it is a begonia, which is not, or a geranium. But yeah, they are sort of begonia-like. They're quite hairy. And oftentimes they have red or pinkish undersides. There are a few cultivars of this plant out there, but they're quite hard to get hold of. And there is a cultivar this plant comes from Japan, I should say. So this plant grows wild in Japan. It's growing in moist, rocky places, often quite urban areas. And there are a few cultivars of this, but there's one that I haven't managed to get hold of, a variegated cultivar called Shishi Henge. I'm probably messing that name up terribly, but it doesn't seem to be available outside Japan. So I'm still would love to get my hands on that. But I think this is a good plant if you, as I say, you want to get something that maybe doesn't need massive amounts of light, that likes moisture and that likes not to be boiled. So if you have a house that doesn't have great central heating, this is a good one for you because it will be fine in cold conditions. It even grows outside here in the UK. I have some outside at the moment, which will get down to kind of -5 without any problem at all. It's got quite a number of different uses.
Okay. So now we're going to move on to a real statement piece indoors. I think that this is such a great choice for indoors if you can manage to make it work, because a lot of people really struggle with this particular plant. And we're talking about staghorn ferns belonging to the Platycerium genus.
Yeah, I mean, I hesitated to put this in, but I do think if you want a beautiful statement plant, this is a good one.
Mm-hmm.
And provided that you've kind of got a sense of its care, you can grow this beautifully. And it's just something that you will be a conversation piece that people will remark on. And once you've got a grip on how to take care of it, you know, it's not that complicated, but you do need to bear in mind that this is a plant that's not going to be necessarily watered in the same way as your other plants.
Mm. So how do we water these plants indoors without, like, getting mildew all on our walls?
Well, this is the tricky bit. I mean, as I say, like this, when you take on a staghorn fern, you have got to realize that this is a commitment. This is not, you're not just like going to the supermarket and buying a moth orchid and it's going to sit on the side and this is a commitment. You are making a commitment to this plant and it is going to involve some mess. And if you have, I mean, I'm thinking of, you know, lovely, you know, Australian houses with beautiful kind of conservatory porch areas. And this is where maybe you might be growing this plant, because yes, it's going to get messy. Basically, another epiphyte, another plant that grows on trees, and it's got this incredible kind of structure of leaves. You could have it planted in a pot. People do, but generally have it mounted onto a wall, onto a piece of wood, and the whole thing needs to be dunked every so often and really. So that the whole thing is allowed to get wet, the whole root ball is moistened all the way through right to the center, which in a big mature plant can be quite a proposition, and then it needs to be drained and hung up again. So, as I say, this is commitment, and you probably do need to have the space to do that and somewhere where maybe, you know, there's not a lot of soft furnishings. Possibly because it's going to be a bit messy. But I think if you can pull it off, it is an absolute treat and a delightful plant. And you can put it outside in the summer under a tree and it will be quite happy outside. Just make sure that you bring it in before you get frosty conditions, which will obviously kill it off because this is a tropical plant. But I think it's a real showstopper. The other downside with this plant is certain pests on this plant are really difficult to eradicate. So things like scale on this plant can be really tricky. So you've got to be on the ball with looking for pests and deal with anything you see really early doors, because it's problematic if a real infestation takes hold.
Okay, so what about dunking? Is that going to kill off the pests if we leave it in the water too long, or are we racing the clock against fungus issues if we do that?
Well, I think the main thing is that you just get into that cycle of making sure the whole root ball is soaked through, then draining and rehanging, and then waiting until it's had a chance to dry out. And it's really about getting to know your plant and looking at the signs that it's getting dry and responding to that. Dunking it in water for a couple of hours in a bucket of water is not going to do any harm. It's not going to kill off pests either, unless you've put some pesticide into that water, but it will be one of those things where it needs that cycle of wet dry, and that emulates how it would be growing in the wild, where it would get a huge downpour and then the plant would be drying out for a bit and then another huge downpour. So you can, yes, you could keep on misting it and, you know, try not to do the bucket thing, but ultimately you're not, particularly as the plant matures, you're not going to get moisture right to the center. And this is the problem. It's also the same problem if you have a big Boston fern, same issue. You've got to get water right through that root ball in order to make sure that the plant succeeds.
Okay. I also feel like the misting against a wall is just a recipe for mildew, whereas if we let it dry out, we're going to help to avoid that.
Yeah, absolutely. Like misting that plant is just like, It's a pointless act, really. I mean, you know, unless you've got a glass house with a misting system set up, like, I just don't think it's going to work.
A drop in an ocean, so to speak.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's the expert level plant. I'd like to tone it down a little bit now. Let's go back to not necessarily beginner mode, but, you know, something a little bit easier than that, because that is definitely an expert mode plant. Let's talk about Sclumbergera.
Yes. I mean, this, I think, is what when people say to me, oh, I'm going to go and buy a poinsettia, I say, stop. Right. Don't buy a poinsettia. Buy a Sclumbergera, because you're much, much more likely to be able to keep this plant going year after year, get enjoyment out of it. And it's a one-time purchase rather than just going out and buying that poor poinsettia every Christmas that you are going to kill, most likely. Mm. And I always get one person who says, well, my poinsettia has been going for 25 years. And I'm like, well, yeah,
well,
great.
I said most likely.
But most people are not going to be in that camp. So this is, you know, a really good plant that will produce beautiful flowers year after year, and probably maybe not exactly at Christmas time, depends on which particular species and cultivar you've got. But I think it's a showstopper, and I absolutely love them.
Mm. It's, I mean, cactus flowers are incredible. It kind of reminds me a little bit of like a dragon's fruit, but like a baby one.
Yeah, very, very good description. That's exactly what they're like. And, you know, when you get a plant that's covered in flowers, dripping with flowers, it just looks amazing. It just is stunning. And they will flower year after year, and they don't need a lot of specialist care. They really are tough. And, you know, I've had one that's had a really bad infestation of root mealybugs, and it looks really miserable still.
Right.
But it still comes up to do amazing flowers.
Right.
So, you know, it really can be quite a toughie. And, you know, it's amazingly, I keep saying the word epiphyte. This is another epiphyte. You know, this is why these make great houseplants. And again, it's one where there's been absolutely tons of breeding, and we get very confused between the Thanksgiving and the Christmas and the Easter cactus. And we're kind of to the point where we can't really define some of these cultivars. But usually the Thanksgiving cactus, the cladodes, which is the flattened stems of the plant, it doesn't have leaves, it has cladodes, are kind of spiky. I always think they look a bit like cat's ears. They're quite spiky. And those are the Thanksgiving cactus, which generally flower sometime in November. And then the true Christmas cactus, Sclumbergera bucklii, has much more rounded cladodes that tend to be more droopy than pointing upright. And that will flower around Christmas time. It's triggered by day length.
In the Northern Hemisphere, right?
Yep. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. What does it do? What does it do in the Southern Hemisphere? This is an interesting point. Never occurred to me.
Well, that's not one I have a whole lot of experience with. But yeah, I mean, when we talk about Christmas in the Northern Hemisphere, generally we're talking about winter, whereas Christmas in Australia is hot and, you know, we have the longer days here.
Oh, well, I'm actually really intrigued now. I've never thought of that. What happens when it's in the Southern Hemisphere?
Well, I would imagine that it flowers in winter, but that's just an assumption. I mean, I don't think that they're waiting for Santa to come.
Well, indeed. I mean, they're triggered by day length. So the flowering is very, very like clockwork, provided the plant is being exposed to natural light conditions, so you don't want to stick it behind a curtain. So I imagine, that would be the case. It's triggered by day length. So as the day length gets shorter, that means the plant is powering up to flower.
Mm-hmm. Well, so that would make a lot of sense.
Yeah, I mean, and it's that's a big reason not to stick it in a room where there is curtains and things obscuring the natural light patterns, putting it under a grow light for longer hours, because that will mess with the flowering pattern. That said, I have an Easter cactus, which flowers always in June. So they don't quite follow the plan.
Yeah, that's not one that I have a whole lot of experience with, but I've seen them around. It's just sometimes you forget what time you've seen plants flowering.
Yeah, no, exactly. I'm going to have to look into that now because that's fascinating. And it hadn't occurred to me, of course. I'm so Northern Hemisphere centric. But, you know, that is a really interesting point. And lots of flowers and houseplants they'll be sensing changes in day length and responding in different ways. And so that's why it's so important to kind of keep an eye on your plants and observe changes. And that will help you to understand them better.
Mm-hmm. Can I blow your mind even more? And you may actually already know this, but in Australia, the Aboriginal people in different areas of the country have identified different numbers of seasons. So, for example, the Noongar people in Western Australia identified 6 seasons throughout the year based off of flowering times, based off of animal activities. And I find that quite interesting. Mm.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the idea that we have, I think that different cultures around the world do have different concepts of seasons. And, you know, I'm often amazed when people don't seem to be that aware of the passing of the seasons. Whereas if you're a gardener, I think it's something that you're always tuned into. And you're right. Like, you know, here in the UK right now, we're having a kind of a long autumn. It's just started to get cold, but I'm judging it by looking at, you know, the quince on my quince tree out the window. And, you know, we've just had a first frost, but there's still, all the leaves are still on the trees. Mm-hmm. So yeah, there are little nuances that we can pay attention to, which really help, I think, to understand what's going on with our plants.
And if you go up even further into the equator, like in Darwin, you'll have 2 seasons. So it's like a hot, dry, mm-hmm. and then a hot, wet. They just don't get winter.
Yeah. Yeah. I lived in Louisiana in the US, and that was what it was like there. It was much more kind of flat. Mm. You know, you had 3 months of the year where it was just hella hot and humid, and then the rest of the year was just kind of pleasant.
Oh, that's lovely. Yeah. Not Darwin. I mean, maybe people get used to it, but yeah, it's hot and sweaty up there. And same thing in a lot of Southeast Asia too. You'll have like certain rain at, like, say it's 4 o'clock in the afternoon. You can just about set your clock by it, and you'll see all these people running out with like carts full of umbrellas, and you'll be like, oh, what time is it? Oh, 3:55. And then sure enough, it just starts raining.
Yeah.
And then you're like, well, I didn't bring my umbrella, so thank you. I'll take that umbrella. I'll buy that.
Absolutely. And this is something that is kind of important to houseplants, really, is that when we think about where our houseplants come from, if our houseplants are coming from tropical environments, that keys into something important, which is that day length is going to be much more similar throughout the whole year for them because they're closer to the equator. So something like a aroid that grows quite close to the equator will probably just be wanting to grow all year round. It won't be having a dormant period. It will be expecting day length to stay roughly the same. And so that's what makes it a good houseplant in a way, in that it'll just grow year round without having a dormancy period. And we probably can expect those kind of plants to keep on putting growth out all year round. Mm. Whereas something like, for example, the cacti and succulents often do have a cool, dry dormancy period where they're going to have a long rest.
Very true. So, yeah, as I said at the start, there's no such thing as an indoor plant. There's just low light plants that we can use indoors.
Exactly. And, you know, one person's indoor plant is another person's outdoor plant. You know, lots of people, you know, living in South America will be like, well, yeah, this plant grows outside. That's totally normal. Or both indoor and outdoor. Mm-hmm. We're very local in our understanding of indoor plants or house plants. But actually, as you say, when we look at it globally, they're just plants.
Mm-hmm. So that idea of indoor-outdoor plants really brings us nicely to the last plant that we're going to talk about today, and that's another SCH beginning name, so Scephlera or Scephlera. This is the umbrella plant. Now, this is a great indoor plant. It's also a massive noxious weed in Brisbane where I'm living these days.
Ah, interesting. Yeah. I mean, this is the thing when you talk to Australians about plants, sometimes there's a different story because some of these plants that we love as house plants are just a real issue. I'm thinking also of Tradescantias, I believe, are another big Australian invasive. So it's always a slight caveat, I guess. Is that caused by people chucking them away and them using them in landscaping schemes and them kind of getting out into the wild?
I'd imagine so in both cases. Like Tradescantia is another one. It looks a lot like what we call, which is a horrible name, but everybody calls it this. I don't know any other name that we call it by. But it's a kind of it looks like a wandering Jew anyway. And I've heard a lot of people calling Tradescantias that. Umbrella plant, Tradescantias, I assume that they're from cuttings that people just throw away. I understand that both do flower as well, but I imagine that that's probably how they start as an environmental weed because they're just so virile as cuttings, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is the thing. Those species are particularly obviously in your climate. It's a similar climate to their native homes, and they will therefore just proliferate everywhere. And it's interesting on the name of the Tradescantia. Yeah, I think that name is one that was very, very, I mean, you still see it used an awful lot. I've chosen not to use that name because from my research, it's not a particularly pleasant implications. So I tend to call it the inch plant, or a lot of people now are calling it the wandering dude, which I also really like. But
yeah, that's
the
cool
clues
one.
In the name, wandering. It's something that's gonna crowd out native plants, which obviously in your very important Australian ecosystems, we don't want to happen.
Mm-hmm. I feel like it's also very resilient as well, which you could say is a positive light that you could put on that.
Yeah, yeah, I hear you. Yeah, absolutely. But I mean, it's so interesting with plant names, and I did for my book, I like researched, and there's a few plant names that are like mother-in-law's plant for
that one I'm down behind. That's a funny one.
Well,
come on, we're gonna have a laugh about that one.
You say that, but then I did a lot of research and actually like it's really hella dark. It's really dark. There's a lot of references back to all these newspaper stories in I think it was maybe the 20s, the 30s in America about this guy going to a botanic garden, seeing this plant, finding out that basically you could use this plant to its name at the time was dumb cane, right? So the hilarious story was that this guy went home and used it on his wife, who ended up in hospital. And this story is in all the papers, you would not believe, in all the papers, it's treated as a massive joke that this guy basically hospitalized his wife with this plant. Just like, that's so dark. It's so dark. It really is quite shocking when you get into it. So I always like, I'm very cautious with common names because some of them are just, you go below you scratch below the surface of a seemingly like innocent name and there's a dark backstory there.
Mm-hmm. Totally agree. So on that note, I think
anyway,
let's get back to
Schefflera.
Yeah, so Schefflera. So tell me more about that plant.
Schefflera is a real classic. Again, if you want a toughie, like if you've got a cafe or a restaurant, you know, want a nice big plant that's not going to cost you a fortune to have, on display that's going to be pretty easy to look after, then this is probably one of the plants you're going to turn to. And there are a few different species out there that people grow, but they're all just really good houseplants with these umbrella shaped leaves, these compound palmate leaves. And the thing from the point of view of nurseries is that they are very malleable. So people will have them as standards. People will have them with three twisted stems going up into a standard or as a bushy plant. Or you can prune them in all different kinds of ways for different effects, which is an advantage from the nursery's point of view, because some people will see that beautiful standard and think, oh yeah, that's for me. But some people want a really bushy plant. So they're very, very malleable in a way. And they will grow fast. If you want to fill a space, they will grow quite fast as well. There is variegated forms. Again, if you like golden splashy leaves, there are options there as well. So yeah, they're a good solid houseplant. I mean, I don't know whether I would describe them as a favorite of mine, but you can't argue with their ability to cope with lots of different conditions and just continue to look nice year round.
Yeah, I mean, I know that we're talking about indoor plants, but there's also a hedging variety too. I'm not sure if that's a different cultivar or just a different species altogether from the one that we keep indoors, but there is a great one for hedging too. So long as you don't cut too deep, because they tend to have that foliage right out on the tip sometimes.
Yeah, you've got to be a little bit careful with the pruning of them. And again, it's like I was saying before, step back and look at what you're doing, because although they grow fast, if you start pruning them badly, then it's not they can look a bit shonky if you don't sort of prune them nicely. But again, as I say, I think this is one of those plants where you really need to think about the setting and giving them a really nice pot and making sure the overall effect is good, because I think it's got to be a specimen plant that stands alone, and so you've got to really put some thought into it. But I think if you pair it with the right pot and keep it pruned in the right way, it can be a real showstopper.
Absolutely. So, Jane, we've come to the end of all of our plants that we'd like to talk to today, and there's just one more question that I always like to ask my guests. Now, as you know, you might remember from last time, it can be about anything you'd like. You can even tell us about your favorite skateboard trick that you learnt on the weekend. Is there anything else you'd like the listeners to know about?
Well, this is a good question. I think what I would like the listeners to know about is that growing houseplants from seed is super fun, and it's a really great way of learning about plants. And you are coming into, in your hemisphere, the time when this might start being something you can try doing. And whether you want to grow a Monstera Deliciosa from seed or a cactus from seed, or maybe you want to try growing a Clivia from seed, there are loads of different houseplants you can grow from seed. Give it a try. You will learn loads. It won't always work, but it's so worth experimenting with. And that way you get plants that are adapted to your conditions from the very first moment you have them. So that's definitely something to look into if you've never thought about it before. If you grow seeds out, outdoor seeds, you can do it with indoor plants too.
I love that. That's great advice. Yeah, it's another sort of like, it's great to buy plants that are already propagated in the nursery, and cuttings are amazing. But there's something about growing seeds that it makes you feel closer to nature in a way. I don't know how to describe it. It sounds so corny to say it, but yeah, it's a magical thing to grow something by seed.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's really worth a try, and you'll be surprised what you can grow.
And the genetics aren't guaranteed either, so it might look a bit different to what you're expecting, depending on the seeds that you're growing.
Yeah. Exactly. I grew some cacti from seeds a few years ago, and I ended up with two cacti that are the same species, but they are quite different. One of them's got longer spines, one of them's got redder spines, and it's just fascinating to see that play out, those genetics play out through your plants.
And that's how we get plant breeds, so new plant breeds. And I mean, absolutely. It's not easy.
You never know, you might find something amazing.
Yeah, and to register plant breeding rights, it's a hell of a journey, but you can make money off it. I would say that that's a pretty awesome career option for some people, not everybody.
Yeah, absolutely. You got to put time and energy into it, but it's some people are really making some amazing steps forward with that. So, yeah, you could be that next person.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for your time, Jane. Great episode. I really enjoyed this chat.
My pleasure, Daniel.
Talk to you soon. So there you have it, 13 of the best indoor plants, in no particular order. That list again is Monstera Deliciosa, Begonia Lucerna, Aspidistra Elatior, Philodendron Hatteraceum, Phalaenopsis, Bocarnia Recurvata, Crassula Ovata, Hoya Carnosa, Escanenthus, Saxifraga Stolonifera, Schlumbergera, and Schefflera.
Head to the show notes to read a full list of the plants and to find a link to Jane's houseplant gardener in a box cards, where you'll find many more of the best indoor plants just in time for Christmas.